This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Wolfskin by Juliet Merrilier. Narrated by Saskia Malleveld. Chapter 1. Winter bites hard in Rogaland. Sodden thatch shudders under its blanket of snow. Within the earthen barns, sheep shiver and huddle, their breath small clouds. A man can lose himself in the drifts between byre and longhouse, and not be found again until the spring thaw. The pristine shroud that covers him is deep, but his long sleep is deeper still. In such a season, the ice forms black and hard on lake and stream. For some, it is a good time. Merchants whip their horses fast along the gleaming surface of the waterways. Sledges piled high with pelts of squirrel and winter hare, with sealskins and oil and walrus tusks, with salt fish and fine embroidery. Boys dart across the river on their bone skates, quick as swallows, voices echoing away to lose themselves among the pale twigs of the winter birches. It was Yuletide, and today there was no skating. The wind screamed around the temple, demanding entry through any chink or cranny its piercing fingers might discover. The timbers creaked and groaned in response, but held firm. So far the roof had not leaked. Just as well he'd climbed up and shifted some of the weight off the shingles, Avon thought. The place would be full to bursting for the midwinter sacrifice. Folk were already streaming into the valley, coming by sledge and on foot, on skis or skates. Old men carried on their sons' backs, old women pulled on hurdles by red-faced children or panting dogs. The wind died down, as if holding its breath in honor of the occasion, but a new storm was coming. Dark clouds built in the west. Avent had been working hard. The temple was on his mother's land, though shared by all in the surrounding district. So the burden of preparation fell squarely on the household at Hammersby. He'd spent the morning chopping wood, stacking the pungent-smelling logs by the central hearth, making and banking the fire. It was nearly time for the ceremony. He should stir the coals now and put on more fuel. The white goat could be heard outside, bleating plaintively. His sisters had swept the stone floor clean and stripped the cobwebs from the roof trees, while his mother, Ingi, polished the bronze surfaces of ritual knives and bowls to a bright, sunny sheen. These now lay ready on the altar at the temple's northern end. Cold light pierced the shingled roof above the hearth. From the altar, Thor's image stared down at Avent, bushy-browed, full-bearded, the god's wooden features held an expression of furious challenge. In his iron-gloved right hand, he gripped the warhammer, Mjolnir. His left was held across his chest to signify the making of some vow. Avent stared back, meeting Thor's gaze without blinking, and his own hand moved to his breast, as if returning a pledge of allegiance. "Till death," he thought Thor was saying. And he whispered his answer. "Till death and beyond." The air was crisp and chill, the sacred space clean and quiet in the cold winter light. Later there would be a press of bodies in the temple, and it would be all too warm. As Avent used the iron poker to stir the embers to life, there was a sound from the entry behind him. He turned to see a tall, broad figure striding toward him, hair and beard touched to dark gold by the glow of the rekindled fire.
"Well, well, little brother. I swear you've doubled in size since the harvest."
Avent felt a huge grin spreading across his face.
"Eric, you're home. And tell me where you've been and what you've been doing. I want to hear everything."
His brother seized him in a brief, hard embrace, then stretched out his hands to warm them before the flames.
"Later, later," he laughed. "Time enough for all that after the sacrifice. We'll have many tales, for I do not come alone." "Håkon is here too," Avent asked eagerly.
He admired Håkon almost as much as he did Eric himself, for his brother's friend had earned his wolfskin at not quite 16, which was generally thought to be some sort of record.
"Håkon and others," Eric said,
suddenly serious.
The Jarl's kinsman, Ulf, is with us. A fine man and a friend of ours. He's brought his young brother and several of his household. They're on their way to Jarl Magnus's court. Ulf has a wish for some delicate silverwork, I think to impress a lady. I made it known to him that our sister's husband is skilled in this craft. They will spend some nights here, in any event. The storm looks likely to prevent further travel for a little. The Jarl himself was urgent for home. He has a new son, bred when we came back from the Spring Viking. He has gone ahead, but we have time before we must join him. He will not set out again before spring seeding is attended to.
He glanced at his brother, and his tone changed.
Eivind, I've a favor to ask you. What?
There were new sounds from outside now, the rapid approach of many folk, voices raised in greeting.
Later,
Eirik said. Eivind asked him no further questions, though it was hard to wait. Eirik was his hero. Eirik was a wolfskin. That was the most glorious calling in the whole world, for surely nothing could surpass the moment when you heard Thor's call to battle ringing in your ears, pulsing in your blood, filling every corner of your being with a red rage that shut out any thought of fear. To charge forward in pure courage, inspired by the god himself, that bold vision tugged at Eivind's thoughts by day and filled his dreams by night. What matter if a wolfskin's life was short? Such a warrior, once fallen, would be carried straight to Thor's right hand. One day he himself would pass the test and become one of that band to which Eirik and Håkon belonged, as had many of Eivind's kin in times past. The men of Hammersby had a noble tradition in the Warfather's service. So Eivind practiced with the bow and with the axe. He ran and climbed, he skated and swam. He shoveled snow and hunted and grew strong, awaiting that day. Eirik's tales kept his dreams alive. Later, perhaps his brother would tell of the awesome Viking, the riches plundered, the battles won. The folk of the district crowded into the temple, along with the men of Jarl Magnus's household, warrior and swineherd side by side. The high seat, its wooden pillars carved with many small creatures, was allocated to Ulf, kinsman of the Jarl, and by him stood the two wolfskins, gold-bearded Eirik and the taller, hawk-featured Håkon. Each wore his short cloak of shaggy fur, fastened on the shoulder with an ornate silver brooch. Both were well-armed. Eirik had the lethal skegux, or hewing axe, on his back, and Håkon bore a fine sword, its hilt plated with copper. The nobleman, Ulf, was young, not so much older than Eirik himself, Eivind thought. He had many folk with him, probably housecarls called into service for the autumn Viking, with a few richly dressed men who might be part of Jarl Magnus's household elite, or Ulf's own retainers. Eivind's eldest brother, Karl, began the ceremony, his solemn features glowing warm in the fire's light. Eivind was pleased with that fire. The smoke was rising cleanly through the roof opening to disperse in the cold air outside. Karl was no warrior. His choice had been to stay at home and husband the land, his brother's portions as well as his own. It was a decision that, in hindsight, had been both wise and prudent, for their father, Hallvard Karlsson, had died in his prime, falling nobly in the service of the old Jarl, and leaving Ingi a widow. A young man with a young family of his own, Karl had simply stepped into his father's shoes. Now he and his mother controlled a wide sweep from hilltop to fjord, and commanded great respect in the district. All the same, Eivind had never understood how his brother could prefer that existence over a life as Thor's warrior. Yet Karl seemed content with what he was.
"Master of storm, tamer of waves, iron-fisted one," Karl now addressed the god in ringing tones. "Hewer of giants, serpent slayer, worthiest of warriors, in blood we honor you, in fire we salute you, in the shadow time we seek your protection. May your strong arm guard us on land path and sea path, smite our enemies and smile on our endeavors. Hewer of giants, serpent slayer, worthiest of warriors, the assembled folk chanted, and their voices rose with the fire's heat to ring out across the snow-blanketed hills and the dark fir trees, straight to the ears of the god himself. Eivind joined in the response, his gaze on Thor's staring, formidable eyes. Now Ingi walked slowly around the temple, bearing the ritual arm ring on a small embroidered cushion. Over many hours, a fine smith had wrought there an image of the world tree with its attendant creatures. The serpent Nithog at its deepest roots, the noble eagle at its tip, the squirrel, Ratatosk, scampering between. The pattern went right around the ring. A man could never see the whole of it at one time. They held the sacrifice at first frost, at midwinter and in spring. At all other times, this treasure was well locked away from curious eyes. One hand after another reached out to brush reverently against the gleaming gold. Girls' hands still soft and milk-pale, men's hands branded by axe shaft and bowstring, gnarled old hands that knew many winters on the land. All moved to pledge allegiance to the warrior, Thor, and to Odin, who had hung on that selfsame tree in search of wisdom. Even the thralls, clustered like a body of shadows at the far end near the door, stretched out tentative fingers as Ingi passed. Karl lifted one of the ritual knives from the altar. The goat was struggling, afraid of the crowd and the fire. It seemed to Eivind that the boy who clutched its neck rope could not hold the creature much longer. If he let go of the rope, the goat would free itself and bolt across the crowded temple in a chaos of hooves and horns. One could not offend the god thus. Eivind got up and moved forward, relieving the red-faced lad of his charge, soothing the animal with soft words and a careful hand. "Go on, then," he muttered. Karl raised the sacrificial knife. The firelight shone bright from its bronze blade. Eivind tightened his grip, forcing the white goat's head back, exposing pink, naked skin where the hair on the throat grew more sparsely. Perhaps sensing the inevitable, the creature made one last desperate surge for freedom. But Eivind's hands were strong. "Hurry up," he hissed. The knife came down, swept across. It should have been easy. Karl was a farmer. Slaughtering stock was a routine task for him. But at the vital moment, a bird shrieked harshly above the smoke hole, and somehow the knife slipped sideways so the blood did not spurt free and scarlet, but only seeped dark against the pure white hair. The goat screamed and went on screaming. The god was displeased. Karl stood frozen, knowing the omen was bad for them. Thor's eyes were fierce and angry on his back. "Here," said Eivind. He took the knife from his brother's fingers, holding the bleeding goat with one hand, fingers twisted in the rope. His legs were on either side of the creature, forcing its agonized form still. This must be done well, now, or there would be failed crops and sick beasts and death and defeat on the field of war. "Iron glove, guide my blade," Eivind said, fixing the god's wooden eyes with his own. "In your name, great battle god." There was only one way to do such things, hard and swift, straight across, nearly severing the neck. Fast, accurate, and merciful. How else could a clean kill be made? The screaming ceased. The white goat went limp. Eivind's sisters held the bronze bowls to catch the blood. There was no telling what Thor thought of the manner of it, but at least Eivind had done his best. He turned to face the folk, helping Karl to lift the slaughtered goat high so the blood could flow into the bowls. Drops spattered hands, faces, tunics. The altar bore a pattern of red spots. A bloody tear trickled down the face of the god. "I will kill cleanly for you," Eivind told Thor, but not aloud. "Let me be a wolfskin, and I will be your bravest warrior. Braver than Håkon, braver even than Eirik. All that I am, I will give to you." He looked down the temple toward the great assembly of folk and straight into a pair of eyes so dark, so piercingly intense, that his heart seemed to grow still a moment, then lurched painfully back into life. His mind had been on Thor and blood and sacrifice, and for a moment he had thought, But no, this was only a boy, a lad of his own age or maybe younger, who stood among the richly dressed entourage of the nobleman, Ulf. But how he stared. He looked at Eivind as a starving wolf gazes at a man across the wayside fire, wary, fascinated, dangerous. The boy was pale and thin, his brown hair straggling and placid, his mouth a line. His features were unremarkable, save for those feral eyes. Eivind blinked and looked away. The girls bore the brimming bowls down the temple, white fingers dripping the blood twigs in, splashing bright crimson on floor and wall, anointing pillar and hearth and doorframe, marking each man and woman with the sacrifice. When the bowls were empty, Carl laid them on the altar beside the knives, and the goat was dragged outside to be gutted and prepared for cooking.
Warfather, we toast you this day of Yule!
Carl raised his great drinking horn. Ingi had passed between the men, pouring the ale with care. One would not wish to offend Thor by spilling any before the toasts were complete.
All hail, great battle leader!
Carl called. They drank.
All hail, mighty Thor, smiter of serpents!
Ulf cried, rising to his feet and lifting his own horn, a fine piece banded in silver. The men echoed his ringing tones and drank again.
We salute you, crusher of giants!
Eric's voice was as fierce as his weathered countenance. So the toast continued, and as they did, the patch of sky darkened above the roof aperture, and the inside of the temple glowed strangely in the fire's light. The boy was still staring. Now the flames made twin points of brightness in his night-dark eyes. Thunder cracked in the sky above. Sudden lightning speared the sky. The storm was on its way.
Thor is well satisfied, said Eric. He calls his greeting to our small assembly. It is a hearty war song. Come, let us move close to the fire and pass the day with good drink and feasting and tales. A long season we spent on the Whale's Way, with the wind biting cold through our tunics, and never a drop of ale nor a woman's soft form in our sight. We thank the god for guiding us home safely once more. We thank him for our glorious victories, and for the rich spoils we carry. In the growing season we shall sail forth again to honour him in deeds of courage. But for now it is good to be home. Let him look kindly on our celebration.
There were many tales told that day, and the more the ale flowed, the more eloquent the telling. There were tales of Thor's valour and Odin's cunning, tales of dragons and heroes. Eivind sat close to his brother Eric, savouring every moment. Of such stuff are dreams made. He wanted Eric to tell them about the awesome Viking, where they had been, what battles they had fought, and what plunder they had brought home. But he did not ask. It was enough for now that Eric was here. That boy was still watching him. Perhaps he was simple in the head. Eivind tried staring back. The boy met his gaze without blinking. His expression did not change. Eivind tried smiling politely, though in fact he found the constant scrutiny unsettling. The boy gave a little nod, no more than a tight jerk of the head. He did not smile. At length, the fire burned lower. The smell of roasted goat flesh lingered. Bellies were comfortably full of the rich meat, and of Ingi's finest oat cakes. The temple was warm with good fellowship. Thor, it seemed, had overlooked the imperfect manner of the ritual, and chosen to smile on them. Håkon spoke.
I have a tale, he said. A tale both sorrowful and inspiring, and well suited for Thor's ears. Since it tells of a loyalty which transcended all. It concerns a man named Níel, who fell among cutthroats one night when travelling home from the drinking hall. Níel had on him a purse of silver, with which he planned to buy a fine horse, and ride away to present himself to the Jarl's court. He was not eager to give up his small hoard, and his chance to make something of himself. For Níel, like many another young farmer's son, was not rich in lands or worldly possessions. He had worked hard for his silver, so he fought with his hands and feet, and the small knife that was the only weapon he bore.
He fought with all his strength and all his will, and he called on Thor for help from the bottom of his lungs. It was a one-sided struggle, for there were 6 attackers armed with clubs and sharpened stakes. Niall felt his ribs crack under boot thrusts and his skull ring with blow on blow. His sight grew dim. He saw the night world through a red haze. It occurred to him, through a rising tide of unconsciousness, that this was not a good way to die, snuffed out by scum for a prize they would squabble over and waste and forget, as he himself would be forgotten soon enough. Still, he struggled against them, for the will to live burned in him like a small, bright flame. Then, abruptly, the kicking stopped. The hands that had gripped his throat, squeezing without mercy, slackened and dropped away. There was a sound of furious activity around him, grunts and oaths, scuffling and a sudden shriek of pain, then retreating footsteps and silence. An arm lifted him up. Odin's bones, every part of his body ached. But he was alive. After all, the gods had not forgotten him. "Slowly, slowly, man," the voice of his rescuer said. "Here, lean on me. We'd best make our way back to the drinking hall. You're in no fit state to go farther." The man who would save Niall's life was young, broad, and big-fisted. Still, there was only one of him. "How did you do that?" Niall gasped. "How did you..." The stranger chuckled. "I'm a warrior, friend, and I keep a weapon or two about me. Thor calls, I answer. Just as well he called tonight, or your last breath would be gone from your body by now. My name's Brynjolf. Who are you?" Niall told him, and later, when his wounds were dressed and the two men were sharing a jug of good ale by the fire, he explained to Brynjolf his plans to present himself to the Jarl and seek a place in his household. "But my money is gone," Niall said ruefully. "My silver, all that I had saved, those ruffians took it. Now I have nothing." "Do you have a friend?" Brynjolf grinned. "And let me see, perhaps not all is lost." He made a play of hunting here and there in his pockets, in his small knapsack, in the folds of his cloak, until at length, "Ah," he exclaimed, and drew out the goatskin pouch that held Niall's carefully hoarded silver. Brynjolf shook it and it jingled. "This is yours, I think." Niall took the pouch wordlessly. He did not look inside or count the money. "You wonder why I did not simply keep this?" Brynjolf queried. "When I said you had a friend, I spoke the truth. Let us travel on together. I will teach you a trick or two, for a man with such scant resources will not get far beyond the safe boundaries of the home farm, unless he learns to defend himself." So Niall and Brynjolf became the best of comrades, and on the way to the Jarl's court they shared many adventures, and they swore an oath deep and solemn, for each scored his arm with a knife until the blood ran forth, dripping on the earth. And they set their forearms together and swore on their mingled blood that they would be as brothers from that day on. They vowed they would put this bond before all other loyalties, to support one another, to stand against the other's enemies, even until death. This oath they swore in Thor's name, and the gods smiled on them. The years passed. Brynjolf joined the Jarl's personal guard and acquitted himself with great valor. Niall learned to use the sword and the axe, but he was not cut out to be a warrior. In time, he had discovered he had a talent for making verses, and this pleased the Jarl mightily, for men of power loved to hear the tales of their own great deeds told in fine, clever words. So remarkably, Niall became a skald, and told his tales at gatherings of influential men, while his friend journeyed forth with the Jarl's fleet in spring and in autumn, to raid along the coast of Friesland and Saxony. When Brynjolf returned, they would drink together and laugh, and tell their tales, and they would pledge their brotherhood anew, this time in strong ale. One summer, Brynjolf came home with shadowed eyes and gaunt features. Late one night, he told Niall a terrible story. While Brynjolf had been away, his family had perished in a hall burning, father, mother, sister, and young brothers. A dispute had festered over boundaries. This had grown to skirmishes and then to killing. Late one night, when all the household slept, the neighbor's men had surrounded the longhouse of Brynjolf's father and torched it. In the morning, walking among the blackened ruins of the place, folks swore they could still hear screaming, though all were dead, even the babies. All this, while Brynjolf himself was far away on the sea, not knowing. When he set foot on shore, they told him, and saw his amiable face become a mask of hate. Niall could think of nothing to say. "I will find the man who did this," Brynjolf muttered, cold-eyed, "and he will pay in kind. Such an evil deed invites no less. He is far north of Frosta, and I am bound southward this summer, but he and his are marked for death at my hand." Niall nodded and said nothing, and before 7 days had passed, his friend was off again on the Jarl's business. Niall put the terrible tale in the back of his mind. It was a mild summer, and the earth wore her loveliest gown. Flowers filled the meadows with soft color and sweet perfume. Crops grew thick and healthy. Fruit ripened on the bushes. And Niall fell in love. There were many visitors to the court. Noblemen, dignitaries, emissaries from far countries, landowners seeking favors. There was a man called Hrolf, who had come here to speak of trading matters, bringing his daughter. Every evening, folk gathered in the hall, and in the firelight, Niall told his tales and sang his verses. The girl sat among the women of the household, and he thought her a shining pearl among plain stones, a sweet dove among barnyard chickens. Her name was Thora, and Niall's heart was quite lost to her snow-pale skin and flax-gold hair, her demure features and warm blue eyes. As he sang, he knew she watched him, and once or twice he caught a smile. Niall was in luck. He was shy, and Thora was shyer. But the Jarl favored his skald, and spoke to Hrolf on Niall's behalf. And at length her father agreed to consider the possibility of a marriage in a year or so, when the girl was 16. For now, it would not hurt the young man to wait. They might exchange gifts. Next summer, Niall could visit them in the north. All things in good time. The lovers snatched moments together, for all the watchful care of Thora's keepers, kisses in shuttered hallways, one lovely meeting at dusk in the garden, hidden by hedges of flowering thorn. They sang together softly, they taught each other verses of love. Niall told Thora she had a voice like a lark. She giggled and put her arms around him, and he thought he might die of joy and of anticipation. Then summer drew to a close, and Hrolf took his daughter home. Brynjolf did not go on the autumn Viking that year. He excused himself from court and travelled north, and with him he took his blood brother, Niall the poet. To distant Frosta they journeyed, and by the wayside they acquired two large, silent companions, men with scarred faces, whose empty eyes filled Niall with dread. There was no need for Brynjolf to tell him where they were going, or for what purpose. It was a quest for vengeance, and Niall's oath bound him to it. He fixed his thoughts on the summer and on his sweet Thora. Life would be good. The comforts of the Jarl's court, the satisfaction of exercising his craft, the joys of marriage. He must simply do what had to be done here and put it behind him, for there was a rosy future ahead. They moved through deep woodlands by night. At the forest fringe, Brynjolf halted them with a hand. Not far below them lay a darkened longhouse, a thread of smoke still rising from the chimney. The folk were abed. A half-moon touched the roof thatch with silver and glinted on a bucket set neatly by the well. "Draw your swords," whispered Brynjolf. "Not one must escape, not man, woman, nor child. Go in quickly, there may be dogs." Then they lit torches from the one Brynjolf had carried, and with naked sword in hand, each ran to a different side of the building. Niall's was the north. He saw the flare of dry wattles catching to east and west. So far the dogs were silent, but it seemed not all there slept. From within the darkened house, close to the place where he stood frozen, clutching his flaming brand, came the sound of a girl singing. She sang very softly, in a voice like a lark's, a little song known only to a pair of lovers who had crafted it one summer's eve in a sheltered garden.
As Hawken recounted his tale, there was a deathly silence in the temple. Some of his audience had seen this coming, knowing the way of such tales, yet still the horror of it gripped him.
What could he do? Asked Håkon. Thora was there, in the house, and already flames rose on three sides of the building, hungry for wattles and timber and human flesh. She was the daughter of Brynjolf's enemy, the man who had cruelly slaughtered his friend's entire family. Níel loved her, and he had sworn a blood oath to the man who had saved his life. Let me die this day for what I do, muttered Níel. Let my eyes be blind and my ears deaf. Let my heart break now and my body be consumed in this conflagration. And he reached out with his flaming torch and set fire to the wattles on the northern side. It was a vengeance full and complete. The flames consumed all. There was no need for swords. When it was over, Brynjolf paid off the hired men, and he and Níel went homeward. Brynjolf thought Níel a little silent, a little withdrawn. Still, reasoned the warrior, the Skald led a protected life. He was not accustomed to acts of violence, to the daily witnessing of sudden death. Indeed, if it had not been for Brynjolf's own intervention, Níel would not have survived to journey forth from the home farm and become a man of wealth and status. They returned to the Jarl's court. For a long time, Níel made no more poems. He pleaded illness. The Jarl allowed him time. Brynjolf was somewhat concerned. Once or twice he asked Níel what was wrong, and Níel replied, nothing. Brynjolf concluded there was a girl in it somewhere. Folk had suggested that Níel had a sweetheart and had planned to marry, but now there was no talk of that. Perhaps she had rejected him. That would explain his pallor and his silence. Winter passed. Brynjolf went away on the spring Viking, and Níel made verses again. Over the years, and he had a very long life, he made many verses. He never married. They said he was wed to his craft. But after that summer, his poems changed. There was a darkness in them, a deep sorrow that shattered even the boldest and most heroic tale of war, that lingered in the heartiest tale of good fellowship. Níel's stories made folk shiver. They made folk weep. A young Skald asked him once why he told always of sadness, of terrible choices, of errors and waste. And Níel replied, a lifetime is not sufficient to sing a man's grief. You will learn that before you are old. Yet when Níel died as a bearded ancient, Thor had him carried straight to Valhöll, as if he were a dauntless warrior. The god honors the faithful, and who is more true than a man who keeps his oath, though it breaks his heart?
After Håkon had finished speaking, nobody said anything for a long while. Then one of the older warriors spoke quietly.
You tell this story well, Wolfskin, and it is indeed apt, a tale well suited for this ritual day. Which of us, I wonder, would have the strength to act as this man did? And yet undoubtedly he did as Thor would wish. There is no bond that can transcend an oath between men, sworn in blood, save a vow to the god himself.
There was a general murmur of agreement, glancing at his mother. Eivind thought she was about to speak, but she closed her mouth again without uttering a word.
It is a fine and sobering tale, Carl said, and reminds us that an oath must not be sworn lightly. Such a tale sets a tear in the eye of a strong man. My friends, the light will be fading soon, and some have far to travel.
Indeed, said Eirik, rising to his feet.
It grows late, and we must depart. I and my companions have journeyed far this day. We return now to my mother's home, to rest there a while. You'd best be on your way while it is still light, for the storm is close at hand. There will be fresh snow by morning.
It was as well the longhouse at Hammersby was spacious and comfortably appointed. A large party made its way there, arriving just before the wind began to howl in earnest, and the first swirling eddies of snow to descend. The nobleman Ulf and his richly dressed companions, the two Wolfskins and a number of other folk of the Jarl's household, gathered at Ingi's home. The wind chased Eivind in the small back doorway. He had arrived somewhat later than the others, after staying behind to make sure the fire was safely quenched, and the temple shuttered against the storm. The instant he came inside, he saw the boy standing in the shadows by the wall, arms folded around himself. There was nobody else in sight. They would all be gathered close to the hearth's warmth. Avon spoke politely, since he could hardly pretend the strange lad was not there.
Thor's hammer, what a wind! My name's Avond. You're welcome here.
The boy gave a stiff nod. Avon tried again.
It looks like you'll be staying with us a few days. There'll be heavy snow tonight. You'd never get out, even on
skis. There was a short pause. Then the boy said,
"Why did it scream?"
Now was Avon's turn to stare.
"What?"
he asked after a moment.
"The goat. Why did it scream?"
What sort of question was that?
Because the sacrifice wasn't done properly, Avon said. It screamed because the knife slipped. It was hurt and frightened.
The boy nodded gravely.
I see, he said.
Avon drew a deep breath.
Come on, he said. It's warmer by the fire. And the others are there, my brother and Håkon and the guests. My brother is Eirik. He's a wolfskin.
There was a satisfaction in telling people this.
I know, said the boy. Eirik Hallvardsson. And there's another brother, Karl, who is not a wolfskin. Your mother is Ingi, a widow. Your father died in battle.
Avon looked at him.
How did you know that? He asked. If I'm to stay here until the summer, I must be well prepared, the boy said flatly. It's foolish not to find out all you can.
Avond was mute.
Your brother didn't tell you, said the boy. I see that. I have a brother too. One who has an inclination to build ships and sail off to islands full of savages. He doesn't want me. I'm to stay here and learn what other boys do with their time. You're supposed to teach me.
Avond gaped. If this was the favor his brother had spoken of, it was pretty one-sided. The boy was pale and scrawny. He looked as if he'd never held a sword or a bow in his life. He spoke so strangely you could hardly understand what he meant, and he stared all the time. What was Eirik thinking?
I'm not going to say sorry.
The boy was looking at the floor now, his voice a little uneven.
It wasn't my idea.
There was a brief silence.
It's all right, Avon said with an effort. It's rather a surprise, that's all. Do you know how to fight?
The boy shook his head.
Not the sort of fight you mean, with knives or fists. What other kind is there?
Avon asked, puzzled. There was the faintest trace of a smile on the boy's thin lips.
Maybe that's what I'm supposed to teach you, he said.
False courage, thought Avond. It must be very hard, frightening even, if you were a weakling and a bit simple in the head, and had no sort of skills at all, to be dumped in a strange household with the kinsfolk of a wolfskin. No wonder the lad pretended to some sort of secret knowledge. No wonder he tried to look superior.
Don't worry, Avond said magnanimously. I'll look after you. Don't worry about anything.
He put out a hand, and the boy clasped it for an instant and let go. He wasn't smiling, not exactly, but at least that blank stare was gone. His hand was cold as a frozen fish.
Come on, Avon urged. I'm for a warm fire and a drink of ale.
He led the way past the sleeping quarters, which opened to left and right of the central passageway. Though it was growing dark, none of the household was yet abed. The days were short, the time after sundown spent in tales by the hearth, and in what crafts could be plied indoors by the light of seal oil lamps. Ingi and her daughters were noted for their embroidery. Carl carved goblets and candle holders and cunning small creatures from pale soapstone. Solveig's husband, Bjarni, was scratching away on his pattern board, making designs which by daylight he would transform into clasps and rings and brooches of intricate silverwork. Helga's husband was away, for the hard winter meant a swift passage by ice roads to the great trading fairs in Kaupang and far-off Birka. In summer he would take ships for ports still more distant, travelling far east. At Novgorod he could get spices and silks from the hot southern lands, fine honey, Arab silver and slaves. Ingi herself had a thrall woman with jutting cheekbones and dark slanting eyes, who shivered through the winter, wrapped in heavy shawls. This exotic slave had two small children. Curiously, neither resembled Oksana herself. Indeed, with their wide blue eyes and golden hair, these infants could have been part of Ingi's own family. Faces turned toward the boys as they emerged from the hallway, Eivind leading, the other behind like a smaller shadow.
"Ah,"
Eric said with a look in his eyes that mingled relief and apology.
"You found Somerled, then?"
Eivind nodded, and went to sit on the worn sheepskins that covered the floor by the hearth. The boy hovered, hesitant. Somerled. So that was his name. Eivind glanced up, jerked his head a little. Noiselessly, the boy moved to settle cross-legged at his side. "Good," whispered Eivind. "There's nothing to be afraid of." Ulf had told no tales at the feasting. He seemed a cautious sort of man, dark-bearded, neat-featured, and watchful. But in the quiet of the home hearth, as the family sat about the fire with ale cups in hand, he seemed to relax and began to talk. It then became evident that Ulf was a man with a mission. He wanted to build a ship, not an ordinary longship, but a vessel such as no man had seen before in all of Norway. And in it he intended to journey where no man of Norway had yet travelled. He would sail to a place that might be real, or that might be no more than fable. With his soft voice and the glow in his dark eyes, he drew them all into his dream.
"There is a land out in the western sea," he told them. "A land my father heard tell of from a man he met at the markets in Birka, beyond the eastern mountains in the land of the Svear. This fellow had travelled far, from wild Pictland southward toward Britain, by sea to the Frankish realms and north to Saxony. From there he took ship to the Baltic markets with his precious cargo, boards set with jewels and fine enamel work, which once housed books in a temple of the Christian faith. The books themselves were discarded, but the bindings were indeed things of wonder, and would make this man rich if he were not slaughtered in the darkness first for what he carried. He had made a long journey. Pictland is a bleak territory, inhabited by wild people. But from its northern shores, said this traveller, far out in the trackless ocean, can be reached a place of warm sea currents, of verdant islands and sheltered waterways, a realm of peaceful bays and gentle grazing lands. The crossing is dangerous from those parts in the vessels they use. Simple skin currags, for the most part. It is a longer path from Rogaland, but not so long that it could not be done if a ship were built strongly enough to withstand the journey. The news of such a place inspired my father. He yearned to travel there, but he was prevented from pursuing it as a lifelong regret for him.
You plan to undertake an expedition to those parts yourself, my lord? Carl asked politely.
Ulf gave a rueful smile.
I make it plain enough, I suppose, that I have inherited my father's obsession. Such a venture would be fraught with risk, but one day I will do it.
You'd need a fine boat,
Eivind said, hoping he did not speak out of turn.
If it's a rough crossing from that southern shore, it could be a rougher one from Rogaland, all the way. It's a brave man who would voyage beyond the Skerrigard, straight out into open seas, into the unknown.
The Jarl's kinsman looked at him with sudden interest.
"I'll build a boat, lad," he said quietly. "She'll be a queen among vessels, sleek, graceful, the equal of any of our shore-raiding ships for speed and maneuverability, but strong enough for a long voyage in open water. I'll gather the best shipwrights in all Norway to work for me, and when the boat is ready, the finest warriors in all Norway will travel with me. I'll see that land while I'm still young, and if it pleases me, I'll take a piece of it in my father's name."
The eyes of every man in the hall had kindled with enthusiasm, for when Ulf spoke of his dream, there was something in his face, his voice, his bearing, that seized the spirit and quickened the heart. It was plain this soft-spoken, reserved man was that rare phenomenon, a true leader.
"It'd cost you an arm and a leg," Eirik observed. "Ships, crew, supplies."
"You doubt my ability to carry this out?"
Ulf's expression was suddenly grim.
"Indeed, no," Eirik said calmly. "I do not. But even a wolfskin likes to know what he's getting into."
Ulf smiled.
"Ah," he said. "I have one taker, then."
"Two."
Orkin spoke from his place on the nobleman's other side.
"You are a man of vision, my lord. A new horizon, an unknown land. What warrior could fail to be drawn by that? I will go, if you'll have me."
Ulf nodded.
"I hope Magnus may be prepared to support us and to release you both. It won't be tomorrow, my friends, or next season. As you say, there must be resources for such an undertaking. I need time. Still, I see the great ship in my mind, her sails full-bellied in the east wind, her prow dragon-crested. I taste the salt air of that place even now."
"The expedition is a fine prospect and stirring to the spirit," Eirik said. "A good farming land is scarce enough here. A man with many sons leaves scant portions. There's more than one likely lad who would jump at the chance to settle in such a place, if it's indeed as verdant and sheltered as you say. You'll find plenty of takers before you go, I think."
"As to that," said Ulf, "I winnow my wheat once, twice, three times before I make my bread, for I am slow to trust. I will not seek all my resources in such a venture to have it end with a knife in the back."
"Wisely spoken."
To everyone's surprise, it was the boy, Sommerled, who spoke.
"My brother is a man with a curse on him. He needs to be rather more cautious than most."
Ulf was regarding his brother with a look of distaste.
"Enough, Sommerled," he said. "We will not speak of that here at this peaceful hearth."
"It's a good curse,"
the boy went on as if Ulf had not spoken.
"A kind of riddle. I like riddles. It goes like this. Pinioned in flowers of straw, cloaked in a mackerel shroud, his dirge a seabird's cry. Neither on land or water does he perish. Ulf, far-seeker, dreamer of dreams, yet tastes the salt sea, watches the wild sky, by neither friend nor foe, slain with his hope before his eyes."
There was silence. It was plain to all that Ulf had not wanted this spoken aloud.
"A strange verse indeed," Karl said after a little. "What does it mean?"
"As to that," Ulf said soberly, rising to his feet, "it seems nonsense. If a man is neither on land nor water, where can he be, flying like an albatross? An old woman spoke such a verse over me when I was in the cradle, that is all. Folk make much of it, but it seems to me a man must live his life without always looking over his shoulder. If some strange fate overtakes me and proves these words true, so be it. I will not live in fear of them. Indeed, I would prefer to forget them."
He frowned at Sommerled, After that, the talk turned to safer matters, and soon enough it was bedtime. Because Somerled was a nobleman's brother and a visitor, the two lads who shared Avon's small sleeping area had to move, and Somerled was given their space. It meant there was more room, which Avon appreciated. He was growing taller. His toes were making holes in his boots, and his wrists stuck out of his shirt sleeves. Somerled was small and slept neatly, rolled tight in a blanket, still as if dead. On the other hand, he had a gift for banishing other people's sleep. That first night, just as Avent, comfortably tired from the long day's work and warmed by the strong ale, hovered on the verge of slumber, Somerled asked another question. "Do you think she screamed?" he inquired. Avent's eyes snapped open.
"What? Who?"
he asked testily.
"You know, that girl, Sora. Do you think she screamed when she started to burn?" "Leave it, will you?" growled Avent,
too annoyed to think of good manners. He had almost managed to forget the story of Neil and Brynjolf and the warmth and fellowship of the Longhouse. Now it came back to him in all its painful and confusing detail.
"I should think she did," Somerled said tranquilly, answering his own question. "I wonder what Neil felt when he heard the singing change. I wonder how it takes you, that moment when everything turns to shadows."
Avent pulled his blanket over his head and stuck his fingers in his ears. But Somerled was finished. Before he could count to 50, he was snoring peacefully. It was Avent who tossed and turned, his mind flooded with dark images. Eirik did offer his brother a kind of apology before he left, and an explanation. Ulf had been concerned about Somerled, Eirik said. The boy had never been quite the same since he witnessed his own mother's death. His father was old and bitter, and had not been kind to his young son, and the household had taken its lead from the master. Ulf had been away a long time, and had returned to a home on the brink of self-destruction. Powerful chieftains gathered close, hovering as scavengers do, awaiting the moment of death. There was a need to take control quickly, to undo the ill his father's mismanagement had created before lands and status were quite lost. But Ulf wanted his half-brother, Somerled was the child of a second marriage, out of the place first. The boy had seen too much already, and was behaving very strangely. He spent all his time alone, he didn't seem to trust anyone, and he never wanted to play games or ride or wrestle as a boy should. Indeed, Ulf scarcely knew what to do with him, and Somerled had made it no easier by refusing to talk. The boy was as tightly closed as a limpet. So Ulf had brought Somerled back to the south, and sought out his friend, Eirik the Wolfskin, a man known to have a great deal of common sense. Eirik heard Ulf's tale and made an offer. He had a brother about Somerled's age. He thought his mother would not object to another lad around the house. Why didn't Ulf leave the boy with them, at least until the summer?
"I must confess," Eirik told Avent with a half-smile. "I welcomed the chance this gave me to return here for a little, and Ulf thought it an excellent idea. Somerled has not had the company of other children, and it shows in his demeanor. He seems unnaturally shy. I've hardly heard him utter a word."
Avent grimaced.
"He talks to me," he said.
"Good," said Eirik. "That's a start. I've a great deal of respect for Ulf. He's a man of vision and balance. I was glad to be able to help him."
"Eirik."
"What?"
"When can I do the trial? How much longer? I'm nearly 12 now, and I've been practicing hard. I can take a hare neatly at 200 paces and swim across the Serpent's Neck underwater without coming up for air. How long must I wait?"
"A while yet," said Eirik. 4 more summers at least, I think."
Avon's heart plummeted. He would not speak his disappointment, for Thor didn't look favorably on such signs of weakness.
But maybe not so long, his brother added, smiling. You are almost a man. What boy has such great hands and feet? And you're nearly as tall as I am, for all I have 6 years' advantage. Perhaps only 3 summers.
That was good news and bad news. Eric thought him nearly grown up. That made his cheeks flush with pride. But 3 years, 3 whole years before he got the chance to prove himself? How could he bear to wait so long? How could he endure such an endless time and not go crazy with frustration?
The weather had eased long enough for Ulf and his companions to be away, and both Eric and Håkon went with them. As if only waiting for their departure, the snow set in again, and Eivind found his days full of digging, clearing paths to wood store and barn, endlessly shoveling the thick blanket from the thatch. Sommerled followed him out, watching gravely as he swung up onto a barrel and clambered to the rooftop. From up there, the boy looked like a little shadow in the white.
"Go back inside," Eivind called down to him. "This is not a job for you."
But Sommerled began to climb up, slipped, cursed, climbed again. On tiptoes, balanced precariously on the barrel, he could just reach the eaves with his upstretched arms.
"You can't,"
Eivind began, looking over, and then stopped the look in Sommerled's eyes. He reached down and hauled the other boy up bodily by the arms.
"Didn't bring a shovel, did you?" he observed mildly. "Watch me first, then you can take a turn. Next time, bring your own. They're in the back, near the stock pens. You need to keep moving, or you'll freeze up and be no use to anyone."
He didn't expect Sommerled to last long. It was bitterly cold. The shovel was large and heavy, and the task backbreaking, even when you were as strong as Eivind was. He worked a while, and then Sommerled tried it, sliding about, losing his balance, teetering and recovering. He managed to clear a small patch. His face grew white with cold, his eyes narrow and fierce.
"All right, my turn,"
Eivind told him, finding it hard to stand idle when he knew he could do the job in half the time.
"I haven't done my share. I can go on." "Rest first, then have another try," said Eivind, taking the shovel out of Sommerled's hands. "You'll get blisters. If I'm supposed to be teaching you, then you'd better learn to listen."
They did the job in turns. It took a while. He glanced at Sommerled from time to time. The lad looked fit to drop, but something in his face suggested it would not be a good idea to tell him to go indoors and let Eivind finish. So he endured Sommerled's assistance, and at length the roof was cleared. When they went back inside, Ingi exclaimed over Sommerled's chattering teeth and his poor hands where lines of livid blisters were forming across the palms, and she chided Eivind for pushing the boy so. Didn't he know Sommerled was not used to such hard work? He should be easier on the lad. Eivind muttered an apology, glancing sideways at his companion. Sommerled shivered and drank his broth and said not a word. Maybe both of them were learning. Several boys lived at Hammersby. Some were the sons of housecarls, folk who had worked for Ingi so long they were almost family. Sommerled did not exactly go out of his way to make friends, and in the confines of the snowbound longhouse, it did not take long for others to notice this, and to set him small trials as befitted any newcomer. Someone slipped a dead rat between his blankets, to be discovered suddenly when he went weary to bed in the darkness. The next day, Eivind spoke to the lads of the household, saying Sommerled was not used to such pranks, having grown up without brothers or sisters, and that it was not to happen again. Nobody actually confessed. The morning after that, Ingi inquired what was wrong with the porridge, to make all the boys look so green in the face. Good food should never be wasted, especially in the cold season. But the only two eating were Eivind and Sommerled, and Sommerled wore a little smile. Later, Eivind discovered the lad's gift had been returned to them in kind. Since there was no knowing who had planted the rat, Sommerled had been scrupulously fair and shared it among them in precisely cut portions. An ear, an eye, a nose with whiskers, a length of gut. He had, it seemed, his very own way of solving problems.